This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The Kalamazoo Promise has been in existence for over 10 years. That has meant free college, or a significant portion of the cost covered for many students graduating from Kalamazoo Public Schools. For researchers, it's been a chance to see how scholarship programs work and try to determine which methods work best. Tim Bartik and Brad Hirschbein are two of the authors of a new report from the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, The Merits of Universal Scholarships, Benefit Cost Evidence from the Kalamazoo Promise. Tim Bartik and Brad Hirschbein, thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
So as an economist, how do you go about trying to measure what the cost benefits are of a scholarship program?
Well, you have to have some kind of data that allows you to infer what the promise has actually done. And what we relied upon is a type of natural experiment. That is, there were eligible students who were eligible for the promise because they had shown up before ninth grade. And there were ineligible students who had come to Kalamazoo Public Schools after ninth grade. And we could compare them to similar students from before the promise existed. And what we then did is we got data on whether they went to college and what colleges they went to and whether they graduated. So we have a natural experiment. All of a sudden, the promise is introduced in 2005, and that dramatically changes the affordability of college for one group of students, the eligible students, and not for the other group of students. So we observe the changes over time. And we find that the promise has large effects on basically increasing college completion, particularly BA completion, by about a quarter or so, from roughly, for BAs, from 30% to perhaps 40%.
Are there particular groups, demographically, that benefit more because of the promise, or does the research indicate that at all?
Yes, actually, we were pleasantly surprised, I think, to find out that one of the largest groups of beneficiaries of the promise were students of color, much more so than white students. And because students of color, largely African American students, make up almost half of KPS students, that's a rather large chunk. And because their base rates of both going to and completing college are relatively low, not only are the increases relatively large just in levels, but from a low base, the proportional increases are very large for students of color. We also found that the effects were much stronger among women than among men, which is unfortunately not very surprising in this type of research. Women tend to respond to educational incentives, particularly money, more so than the men do. But there were different effects for different groups, and it was not just the most well-off students who were benefiting, but actually students who were financially constrained also showed relatively large increases.
If we were to drill down a little bit more, is it possible we would find that some students who were not planning to go to college are now going to college because of the Kalamazoo Promise? And there may be other students who were going to go to college, and maybe they show up in a different sort of way, that they're going to a different college. They were going to go to Kalamazoo Valley Community College, but now they can afford to go away to school if they want to. Do those things show up in research, or is that something you haven't gotten into yet?
Well, it's a little hard to say, but I think that is going on. I mean, we suspect that what's going on is that some students wouldn't have gone to college at all are now getting associate degrees. Some students who might have gotten associate degrees are getting bachelor degrees. And I think there is some evidence that some students who wouldn't have gone to the University of Michigan or Michigan State, the flagship schools, will now go to those schools rather than some other schools they might go to. So I do think there's some changes in what colleges people go to and what kind of degrees they get. So far, we're just looking at how the returns to the promise vary based on whether you get a college degree, but probably there may be a greater return to getting a BA from University of Michigan than from some other schools.
If I could just add to that, I would like to say that we generally are finding evidence consistent with an upgrading effect, that students who would have, say, not gone at all are now going to KVCC, the community college, and those who are going to the community college now seem to be going to, say, Western. And as Tim mentioned, and so on and so forth. But we think that upgrading effect could actually have implications for other similar promise-type programs or even free college movements like what's going on in Tennessee or Oregon and a few other places, that when you do make college free, particularly community college, a lot of students who otherwise wouldn't have gone at all now make that step. And that's an additional challenge for those types of schools to try to have support services for those types of students, because they are overwhelmingly first in their first generation, first in their families to go to school, and they have their own challenges necessary for success.
One of the things you say about trying to create a scholarship program is there's a couple boxes that you're going to want to check here. Getting political support, efficiency, efficacy. In other words, you know, that you want it to work well. You don't want it to cost more than it should. And of course, you want support for it. What is the evidence here that the Kalamazoo Promise and the way that it's constructed gets at all of those things? Do we see right now that it is working in that way, that people support it, that it's efficient, and that it is leading to the results, as you mentioned, that show that it's getting more students to college and getting them degrees?
Well, it's certainly efficient in that what we find is that for every college scholarship dollar that's put into the Promise, or every dollar of spending that the Promise donors are putting into it, the returns are very high. The overall average return we find is almost the increased career earnings in present value terms is almost $5 for every dollar put into the program by the Promise donors. And we find different things for different groups, but for most groups, we find that many more dollars of earnings occur for every dollar of college scholarship. So it's definitely efficient in that sense. It's got a high bang for the buck. The other question is effectiveness. What does it do to increase college access and completion? And we do find it does move the needle quite a bit. It doesn't solve all the problems. So, for example, the overall attainment of a college credential goes from 36% to 48%. And that is literally a case where you can say glass half empty, glass half full. We've moved the college credential completion rate as of 6 years after high school graduation to 48% from 36%. That's a 12% increase. That's a one-quarter increase. That's quite a bit. On the other hand, 52% are not getting a college credential. Now, some of them may get it before 10 years, but, it has moved the needle. It is effective in that sense. So we are finding that a universal scholarship program such as the Promise, when implemented in an urban school district, can both have a high bang for the buck and can move the needle on college completion rates.
And I just like to say that the metaphor, the analogy I like to use, it's kind of like an onion. And that once you actually remove the financial hurdle, which is a huge hurdle for many different types of students, you remove that outer layer, and then you can see the remaining layers and the hurdles that remain. And a lot of that's academic preparation or navigating through college. And we now see those hurdles. We now have to react to those hurdles. And many of the schools, both K through 12, as well as the colleges, are beginning to respond, but that takes time. And so the money is only one of the major hurdles, and several still remain. And we're seeing, hopefully, that there will continue to be some improvement as time goes on, as these additional hurdles can be dealt with.
Is one of the things that makes a universal scholarship program work better, if it does, than others, is simplicity, that there is not the confusion about who's eligible, who's not eligible. It's relatively straightforward, not a lot of paperwork. Is that one of the merits that perhaps helps to achieve things like political support?
Well, I think simplicity is a key thing. I mean, the Promise is just a one-page form with just a few data items. And I think Brad can talk a little bit about that. There's a lot of information that one thing that impedes financial aid in the U.S., it's too complex for a lot of people to navigate. There's a whole research lit on that.
Sure. The normal way of applying for federal financial aid is through filling out the FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, which is a notoriously complicated form that has over 100 questions that many people who have gone to college themselves struggle to fill out, with very detailed information on assets and finances. And certainly if you're first in your family to go to college, or if your parents don't speak English, it's very challenging to do that on your own. And there's been a lot of research that's been advocating and finding that if you simplify this form, you can afford to boil it down to just a few questions and still get most of the information needed to get accurate amounts of financial aid for most people. But because of that barrier, a lot of people don't even bother filling it out, and then either take out private loans or try to pay for college themselves, or just decide it's not worth it at all. So the simplification of the aid and the fact that the Promise has just half a dozen questions, including things like what is your address, that's are relatively straightforward to fill out, is certainly a big part of its appeal and its simplicity.
There's a lot of money left on the table, I think, is what people say often about federal financial aid because of the forms and because it is a lot of questions to work through.
You need to give people an offer that they can understand. Traditional financial aid has not done that. The promise is an offer they can understand, and it means the promise is pretty simple. It basically says, if you attend Kalamazoo Public Schools and live in the district starting from at least a certain grade, you will get a college scholarship. It doesn't depend in any complicated way on your finances, on your grades, or anything else. It's pretty straightforward.
What does this tell someone who may be in another community? Because we have seen promise-like scholarship programs get started, some of them very similar to Kalamazoo. Many of them are not similar at all. They have much different requirements, may have a grade point requirement, may have some other things in it, may have a financial component. So what do you think your research says to someone in Anytown, USA, who is thinking, you know, we need something like the Kalamazoo Promise? How should we go about doing it?
Well, there are certainly many other communities, as you mentioned, that are thinking about it. And part of the balance is how many people can you reach effectively, but also what kind of budget do you have? Many of the other communities that have been considering promise-type programs, not everyone has anonymous billionaires or multimillionaires that are willing to finance this project, and that money isn't always readily available in the community. So there are very real limitations or balancing between the amount of money and how many people you can help. What our research shows is that the simplicity and universality and generosity of a program like Kalamazoo's can be very effective in terms of reaching a lot of students and getting them through college. Other programs that have need considerations, financial need considerations built in, or have merit requirements such as a GPA requirement, there's ongoing research into some of those other programs, but in general, the effects are found to vary a little bit. There's not so much done yet on completion, but it's reaching fewer people. Is it helping some people who actually meet the merit requirements? Yes, but it's also leaving a lot of people behind.
Right. And I think the thing to emphasize is, so the Kalamazoo Promise is not targeted based on student need. And yet what our research finds is that the program is effective for students of color, and the program is effective for low-income students. So even though it isn't targeted based on need, it is reaching students who suffer from disadvantages either based on family income or based on race.
And that's one of the reasons why programs like the Kalamazoo Promise or other similar promise programs, if they're adopted in communities that have a large number of low-income students, can still be rather cost-effective and effective in getting people through college sense, even if they are universal and are available to everybody.
All right, spoiler alert, I'm going to move to the conclusion of your report and read the end. So if someone is planning to read it themselves, maybe this is the time to turn down the radio for a moment. We find that the universal college scholarship of the promise for a wide variety of groups easily passes a benefit cost test. But I want to go back to what you just mentioned, Brad, about not everybody has the wealth in their community, has the donors that are willing. The cost in there can be considerable. When you're talking about cost-benefit, how do you weigh the fact that it is not easy to come up with this amount of money, especially if you are, in somewhere which maybe is not economically advantageous?
That is definitely a real struggle. The Kalamazoo Promise is spending roughly around a little bit over $11 million a year to send somewhere around 3,000 to 4,000 students who are on the promise at any given time. So other communities that may be smaller, that amount will be smaller. But for some of the communities that are larger that have adopted promise-type programs, places like Pittsburgh, that's even more money. So it's definitely a very thoughtful issue that communities are trying to balance the money and see where they can get it from. What our research shows is that it can still be effective in these places, even if you can come up with the additional money to hit everybody. But in terms of how you should pair it back to be most efficient, we're still trying to figure out whether that can be done more cheaply. We just don't know yet.
On the other hand, from a larger perspective, if these programs raise earnings and boost the overall economy, the question is whether you're being penny wise and pound foolish by not investing in the programs. And, you know, we do see around the country states and communities getting in, moving into this area, maybe not to a full four-year degree, but, you know, Tennessee just, I think, was this fall, they moved into free community college for all graduates of high schools in Tennessee. And Oregon, is it next year? Or that there's
this fall.
This fall, that the Oregon will be doing something similar. So there definitely are places that are looking at public financing, at least for the first 2 years, or at least for community college. So.
Is there an argument that you could make that eventually, long-term, such a program can pay for itself by the things you mentioned, increased earnings and those sort of things?
Yeah, potentially. It depends on what you assume happens with the we're just looking, actually, at the increased earnings for the graduates themselves. I mean, one of the issues with education, why do we have public investment in education? Let's talk about the broader philosophical issue. Yes. I mean, one of the reasons would be it's widely believed that there are some really positive external benefits to others of the more education. You know, people more educated tend to vote more. They participate more in civic life. There's also a belief that in terms of the economy, that there may be spillover benefits on the overall productivity of the economy. In other words, I may benefit if my coworkers are more skilled. Maybe my employer can introduce new technologies easier. And so there is potentially a very, very large collective payoff that could, in the end, enlarge the entire tax base. But I don't want to overpromise. There's not some miracle Laffer curve in the short run where these things magically pay for themselves immediately. When we say they pay for themselves, they might pay for themselves 20, 30 years, 40 years down the road, because, you know, obviously a lot of the payoff to college is not occurring right after college.
Right.
It's occurring when people get in their 30s and 40s, their peak earnings years. So it definitely would be an investment, but in the long run, it might end up being self-financing.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. We're talking about college scholarship programs, the Kalamazoo Promise and others, with Tim Bartik and Brad Hirschbein. They're both economists with the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. So you've told us that there is this benefit to the Kalamazoo Promise that seems to really help students of color, has helped women. But at the same time, you have also told us that overall, college graduates earn less if they grew up poor. And Brad, let's explain here exactly what we mean by earn less. Not just total dollars, but the benefit is just not as great, is it?
Yes. So we actually stumbled upon this finding when we were trying to do the benefit cost of the promise for different groups. And one of those groups were students who were in assisted lunch, the free or reduced price lunch program in high school, which is generally the indicator we have for low income status for students. And because it's difficult to figure out what the earnings are for people who grew up, if not poor, certainly lower income, we actually had to go to a data set that follows the same people for generations and their descendants. It's not in most of the major data sets we often use. And so we wanted to actually figure out what the earnings were over the lifetime for these people. And so we went to this data set. And we actually compared people whose parents qualified them or had low enough incomes to qualify them for the low-income, the assisted lunch program. And we compared students who qualified for that program based on their parental income and those who didn't, and then followed them throughout their careers and saw what their earnings were. And we did this based on what different levels of education they themselves ultimately got. And what we found was not only were the people who grew up and who were eligible for the lunch program, did they make lower earnings, even if they got a bachelor's degree, than people who grew up with incomes too high to be eligible for this program. But the increase in earnings when going from having just a high school degree to a bachelor's degree, if you actually grew up lower income and eligible for this lunch program, that increase was much smaller than it was for the people who went from a high school to a bachelor's degree and did not grow up eligible for this lunch program. And it was a significant margin. The people who grew up eligible for the program, their increase in earnings when going from a high school to a college was about 90% over their career. For the people whose parental incomes were higher than this threshold, who were better off growing up, the increase in going from high school to a bachelor's degree was about 160% over the career. And that adds up to a lot of dollars.
I want to emphasize this is a little bit of a surprising finding. It's not surprising that your kind of family background affects your earnings. I mean, your life experience, anything in your life experience might affect your earnings, your connections, your networks, where you live, variety of things. What is surprising is that it particularly affects the return to a college education and that it lowers it by quite a bit. And I want to emphasize it still means that college pays off by quite a bit for someone who grew up in a low-income background. It just doesn't pay off quite as much. Also, these are averages. None of this says that for any particular individual, I mean, there's huge variation across individuals in the return to college. And so, you know, you can't use these to say definitively for any given person, this is what the return to college is going to be. But on average, it seems as if growing up in a low-income background seems to handicap the return to college for, on average, for people from that low-income background.
Tim, as someone who has studied this in, you know, your professional life, has you have a background of having served on the school board in Kalamazoo. Obviously, you're someone pretty invested in education. Was this surprising to you to come across this number and find that there was not quite the benefit that people might think there is?
Well, it is surprising. As I said, we don't see this, for example, actually in, say, African-Americans versus whites. The return to college seems very similar for those two groups. So it's not true across different racial groups. It does seem to be true across different income background groups. And, there could be a lot of explanations. It could be due to differences in family background on average between the two groups. It could be due to differences in the neighborhoods you grew up in. It could be due to differences in high school quality or your high school experience or your high school test scores. It could be due to differences in the types of colleges people go to. It's not due to whether or not you go on beyond college to get a medical degree or a business degree or whatever, because we found the same thing when we just looked at people who just completed 4 years of college. It could be due to what kind of occupations people go in. Maybe people who come from upper income backgrounds are more likely to get into high tech or finance, and maybe people who come from a low income background go into somewhat lower paying occupations. So we're looking into all this, what's going on. It could be due to networking effects, who you know. I think it's very important for us to think about this because, one key issue in the U.S. is how do we make opportunity equal across all groups? And if the return to college is much lower for one group than another, and we're talking about sizable magnitudes, that's disturbing in terms of equal opportunity as one of our ideals.
Does it tell us something about, to bring it back to the Kalamazoo Promise and Scholarship Programs, does it tell us anything about that? Because, again, you did find some good returns for the Kalamazoo Promise. So is a universal scholarship program one tool that might chip away at this a little bit?
I think that's exactly the right phrase to use, that it's one tool that might chip away at it a little bit. There are certainly many other tools that will probably be needed to chip at it even more. And so even breaking it down for the different groups, and we find positive returns that the promise is actually benefiting several of the different subgroups that we looked at, particularly the women, the students of color, economically disadvantaged students. But that's not enough. We really need to figure out why the returns can be limited even for some of those groups. And if many of the low-income students in particular that we're finding this differential return, if we can begin to unlock that black box and try to understand what are some of the factors that are actually seeming to limit or hold back their earnings potential, maybe some of those are things that are actually policy levers that we could actually try to change to open up greater opportunities. I suspect, along with Tim, that a lot of them are things that we might be actually able to change, including mentors, having certain connections and network opportunities, and making sure that people know what options are out there for them, that they have that information, they have someone to help guide them. As we mentioned, a lot of the low-income students are first generation. That's not at all uncommon. And many of those students struggle to figure out what opportunities are available to them because they just were never able to observe them growing up.
Is it important to get at some of those questions Tim was just asking, that, again, it's possible it could be because of networking, it could be because of the occupations people go into, but is it important as researchers now to kind of drill down on those questions and get at what it is that might cause this discrepancy?
I definitely think so. It's been rather challenging because there's so many things that could be going on, and trying to isolate them and apportion them out is a challenge. We're going to try to do what we can with the data that we have. But knowing which factors are responsible is telling you where to actually have a policy or where to actually change things that might actually have results. And so if we don't know how to change them, then the quality of opportunity is going to continue to be a threat.
And I think it shouldn't be seen as discouraging in the sense that, you know, any complex social problem has multiple causes and multiple ways you can affect it. So, you know, one of the things this indicates is just because you have a Kalamazoo promise, it doesn't necessarily solve all problems of equal opportunity. Opportunity can still be unequal for other reasons. And it's important to look at what some of the other reasons are. If it ends up being, for example, maybe the neighborhood you grew up in is a key factor, well, then that would indicate that we need better policies to have more income integration in neighborhoods and have more equal neighborhood quality in the U.S. than we currently do. If it maybe it indicates that the type of college you go to, in which case you need to work on that. Maybe it's the occupations people go in. Well, maybe we need to give better advice to people on what the, you know, relative job prospects are in different occupations. So, you know, you usually can't solve a problem of disadvantage just with one policy. But that shouldn't be a council of despair. Even after we allow for the lower return to college for low-income students, we find that the Kalamazoo promise still pays off big time for low-income students.
Tim, in addition to research on the Kalamazoo Promise, we often talk to you about quality preschool education. You recently participated in an event at the American Enterprise Institute. You had a post on your blog saying, "We have enough evidence to expand quality pre-K." First of all, explain what that evidence is, and then how do we go about expanding it?
Well, the evidence we have is not just we have some well-known experiments such as the Perry Preschool Study from Ypsilanti, Michigan, but we also have some evidence from very large-scale programs, the Chicago Child Parent Center Program, which is a preschool run by Chicago Public Schools. We also have universal preschool programs in Tulsa and Boston for which there's good evidence, and there's actually some good evidence from Michigan's programs that these programs have an effect. So we have considerable evidence that pre-K programs pay off. And, you know, what I think that points to for policy is we need to expand pre-K as long as we can make sure the expansions are high quality. No one is saying that pre-K pays off if it's low quality, but if we can make sure the programs are high quality, which seems to depend in particular on whether or not we can get good teachers. Can we pay the salaries that are needed to attract and retain good teachers, and can provide the right kind of training to make sure that the teachers in pre-K are effective?
You say in one of your writings here that we should err on the side of over-investing in quality, the point you just made, while answering the many remaining research questions by evaluating alternative program designs. What are those questions that still have to be answered?
Well, you know, like in anything, I mean, once you get social scientists involved in anything, it turns out that when you analyze it deeply enough, there are always remaining research questions. I mean, I don't know of any social science paper that doesn't end with, "We need more research," you know. But, you know, the point is you need to be careful about over-interpreting that. I mean, it's possible to say, well, we don't have perfect knowledge, and therefore we shouldn't do anything until we have perfect knowledge. Well, if we adopted that approach, we never would have had public schools in the U.S. because we didn't have randomized controlled trials of public schools before we started them in the 19th century. You know, and so some people, what don't we know? Well, we don't know perfectly exactly what are the skills in preschool that are most crucial for determining adult success. We know that it's more than test scores, because we know that a number of preschool programs, including the Perry Preschool Program, that the effect of the program on test scores, they were very, very high at kindergarten entrance. And then by third and fourth grade, most of them had faded away. So in Perry Preschool, by third or fourth grade, the program had very little effect on IQ test scores of the preschool participants versus the control group that did not go to preschool. Yet the program found that when people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, they had much higher employment rates, much higher earnings rates, lower rates of involvement with any criminal activity. And so, you find very large returns of the Perry Preschool Program in terms of both increasing earnings and reducing problems due to crime, even though the test score effects had mostly disappeared by third or fourth grade. Now, people looking at that have said, well, it must be due to some kind of effect on so-called soft skills, social skills, self-confidence skills, character skills, whatever you want to call those skills. Well, I mean, from a social science point of view, you'd like to be able to measure those skills. You'd like to be able to find out what are the most important soft skills to really affect earnings and prevent people from getting involved with crime. We don't currently have great measures of soft skills. There are people looking at this, doing research on it. It's very, very hard to measure. Right now, we don't have a great way of measuring them. Ideally, we would like to have great measurements of these so that we could see what these programs are doing and affecting these soft skills. That's just one example of what we don't know for certain. And that also creates a problem for measuring the quality of preschools. I mean, you don't want to measure the quality of preschools simply by how many letters or numbers kids learn in preschool. You also want to know how much kids are progressing in these soft skills. Well, if you can't measure the soft skills very well, it's a little difficult to have definitive measures of program quality. What we do know, though, is that the programs that have paid off, and that's true of Perry Preschool, Chicago Child Parent Center study, the Tulsa Preschool Program, the Boston Preschool Program, have all had teachers in the program. The lead teacher was a certified teacher. The lead teacher had some kind of certification in early child education, and the lead teacher was paid salaries that at least were competitive, if not equal to, public school teacher salaries. So you didn't have the preschool teachers constantly leaving to go off to become a kindergarten teacher. And teacher turnover, we know from numerous studies of education, is a key problem in affecting educational quality. So I think we do know enough to know what are the necessary elements for preschool quality. Would we ideally like to know more? Yes. But do we know enough to move forward? Yes. Because there are two types of errors you can make in public policy. One error is going too far. The other error is not doing enough.
Paralysis, because you're waiting for...
Because you're waiting around for the perfect evidence. Yeah. And you know, you could always say, well, gee, let's have another randomized control experiment where we wait around 20 or 30 years to see what different types of preschool programs do. Well, in the interim, of course, a number of kids who could have benefited from quality preschool won't benefit if you simply wait around all the time. So, you know, what I was basically urging at that AEI event was that we need to consider both the risk of action and the risk of inaction. And on the whole, I think there's sufficient evidence, both of preschool's effectiveness and on what are some of the essential elements of high-quality preschool. And if you're concerned about whether or not it will work, I think the approach is let's try to make these programs, let's try to err on the side of overinvesting in quality. Later on, maybe we can find out we can cut the cost a little bit. But for now, let's overinvest.
Tim Bartik and Brad Hirschbein, thank you both for your time.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Thanks.
Tim Bartik and Brad Hirschbein are both economists with the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.